Today on the show, we have Radhika Paliwal. She's a real estate investor, computer engineer, speaker, personal finance enthusiast, and we're here to talk about her book, From Ramen Noodles to Riches. Radhika, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bert. Thank you for having me.
All right, so first thing off the bat, I love the title, From Ramen Noodles to Riches. What inspired you to write the book? What's the background? Give us some insights.
Yeah, there were a few different reasons I wrote the book. Honestly, a lot of it came from my frustrations. As you know, my background's in computer engineering. I didn't really study finance. It wasn't really a topic. I wasn't taught it. My parents didn't really talk about it. So one of the reasons I wrote this book is to share the knowledge that I've been learning over the years and help other people get that knowledge without spending the amount of time, and research and countless hours and even money for that matter that I've spent just for my financial education. That was a huge component for it. And then the second big reason I wrote this book is, to be honest, it's kind of sad to see, a lot of people in this day and age, and especially, I mean, in 2024, it's a rough market out there. If you look at like the larger economic conditions, it's just a rough market, and people are having a hard time with even things like grocery prices and rent prices and your daily cost of living. And I just think if we had better financial education, ideally in high school, maybe even earlier middle school, we would be better off. So my way of writing From Ramen Noodles to Riches was a way to give back to one, a younger version of me, and two, the masses of people who are just trying to figure it out.
Yeah, it's amazing to me, and I agree with you. First of all, I think elementary might be a good time to start thinking about teaching your children about finances. I think that most people grow up in a environment where money is not talked about. There's a lot of negativity around money. I think that one of the reasons for that is because most parents don't know anything about money.
Correct.
I didn't really start getting a grasp on my money until I was probably closer to 40.
Wow, yeah.
And it might have been maybe my mid-30s, maybe 35, but still, that's a long time.
Right.
And by that time, you've already made so many mistakes with credit cards and things of that nature.
Yep.
And I think the other issue for most people is that there's so much confusion about money. I remember when I really started getting into finances, I had signed up for a couple of programs, and it was almost like a full-time or part-time job trying to figure things out, how money works, where to invest it, all these things that with my kids is I started teaching them about money as early as possible. I to this day, my son, my oldest son, I taught all my kids how to be more entrepreneurial. I think he was 6 or 7. He wanted to earn some money to buy a toy. It was like a $40 toy, which I'm not going to buy him. But I said, hey, let's see if we can get you some. Maybe you can help the neighbors and earn some money. And that's what he did. He helped some neighbors. And I helped him pass out flyers. He earned $100. And when it came time to buy the toy, he goes, I'm not spending $100. I'm not spending my money on a toy, Dad. It took me too
Wow.
long. It took me too long to earn the money. And he's become very frugal, he's much wiser with his money than I was. But it is a weird thing that for living in a country like America that's so abundant, we really, as a society, are confused about money. We don't teach about money. And it's really, I think, hurting us generally.
Yep, agreed, agreed. You bring up such a good point. There's two things that are top of mind for me. One, I actually, a few months ago, I was reading an article where it talked about the way you think about money, like the money psychology you have, is actually starting to develop at age 4. Think about that. Like age 4, you don't even, I mean, like I think back to 4, I don't think I even have any real memories from it other than probably wanting candy all the time and understanding the word no, right? And so the fact that like these people have researched and figured out at that like age four is when we start conceptualizing what money means to us. Parents do heavily influence like our decisions and our relationship with money. And it's hard to change that over time. It's hard to figure out like where your thoughts about money are coming from, but also what do you do with them as an adult, right? And then the second thing I was going to share is one of my friends, you talked about, you know, the mistakes we've made in the past and what we learn again from parents. One of my friends, he grew up learning from his dad that credit cards were great and they were the best thing. And I mean, like, I have credit cards. I love credit cards, right? But he grew up in the sense that you're not supposed to pay your credit card like debt back. And so this entire time, he's, you know, mid-30s right now, this entire time, him and his parents thought that that balance that you see is good, it's fine. And the minimum amount you have to pay, what is it, like around $40, depending on company to company, card to card. That's all you have to pay, and that's all that matters. And he didn't know until he was, yeah, like, you know, late 20s, early 30s, that that's not a good thing and it's hurting his credit score. And he wasn't able to get an apartment or look at even like car leases. And that's when he realized, oh crap, I can't trust or rely on my parents, which is kind of sad to think about. But if that's all you know, that's all you know.
Absolutely. And the way credit cards make their money is they want you to pay that minimum. They don't
Correct.
want you to pay it back. They don't, you know, they they're in it for the
Exactly.
profit.
Exactly.
So, all right, so give me a little bit of background. What happened in your personal journey that you decided, okay, this money thing matters. I better start figuring it out. And even
Yeah.
got to the point to write a book.
Yeah. Honestly, it's because I became an adult, got a real life adult job, and I still was losing my money. I mean, like every weekend, somehow I was spending hundreds of dollars on just eating out and drinks with friends, going to a movie theater, maybe a comedy show here and there, and boom, just like that, like the paychecks that I was getting as like a great job weren't actually sitting in my checkings account because I had to pay my credit card bills at that point. And I was just so confused for the first few months. I'm like, I don't understand. I'm earning money. Where is it going? Right. So it started with confusion. Then I think it quickly transformed into anger, where I'm like, I'm so angry I wasn't taught this. I'm so angry, like the school system or my parents or even my friends don't speak about things like this. And then from there on, I'm like, okay, well, that's that, right? I can't change the past. I can't change what's been done. What do I do about it now? So I took a lot of time to understand what does like personal finance mean to me. And I started with my job, mostly because they help set you up with a 401k. You have tools like the HSA on your hand. My company also offered an ESPP at that point. I didn't know what, you know, the HSA and ESPP meant, and I had a general idea of a 401k, but that's about it. So I started learning about those through my corporate resources. And then I expanded more by picking up a few personal finance books, watching a lot of YouTube videos. And then eventually, like once I had my basic savings account set up, as well as my basic brokerage account set up, and like recurring investments, then I started expanding my interest into, okay, what else can I do with money? How else can I make it work for me? And that's when I got into real estate a bit more and, you know, really thought about what does real estate mean? How can I invest in it? Well, I have no background again. So how can I meet people who have properties? What does that process look like? And I spent countless amount of, again, like hours and months learning about it to be able to do it myself.
Yeah, I think that's a very common story. It reminds me of the episode of Friends where Rachel gets her first paycheck and she goes, "Who the heck is FICO?"
I wiped tables for it, I steamed milk for it, and it was totally not worth it. Who's FICA? Why is he getting all my money?
Yeah, I do remember that. I love that episode. And why is he
It,
taking all my
that's
money?
exactly
Yep.
it, and it is amazing to me again that as parents we don't know anything about money and we pass that ignorance to our children. What I remember growing up about money, I did hear no quite a bit, and I heard, we can't afford it, we don't have the money. And I think that does stick with you. And I think that the other thing that's amazing is how many people never challenge themselves to learn about money and how to get the money to work for them, to work for them. Because once your money starts to make you money, it's very exciting. I remember the first time I got like $2 or $3 from a dividend. It's like, wow, $2 or $3, but it's $2 or $3 that I got for nothing. It's like, it was like, I don't know. It was almost like Christmas. It's, wow, this is exciting. This is
I
great.
mean, you can get like a packet of gum with that. That's pretty good. So the other thing, the other like you reminded me too, like the other big thing for me has been I'm the oldest in my family and I have two younger siblings. So sure, like again, I got over my confusion and my anger. And then once I realized I'm doing this for myself, my siblings are 6 years and then 12 years younger than me. So there's a huge age gap between us. By the time like I'm going through these changes, they're not in the headspace or even care about what I'm going through, right? So like I wanted to document a lot of this for them. And that's really where I started with the idea of writing a book. But on my sister's 18th birthday, what I did was I said, kind of what you did with your kid as well. I said, hey, I could buy you like AirPods, or I will put money directly into your brokerage account. And you have the freedom and flexibility to choose your investments because you get to have that ownership of it. Like, this is your account. But, like, again, I will help advise you or like teach you about ETFs versus stocks versus whatever. And I remember when she got her first dividend, I think, again, it was just like a little bit of money. So her first dividend was 10 cents. And she called me up when that happened. She's like, can you believe it? Like, I just earned 10 cents. What does that mean? I mean, it's not really anything, but you know, like, how can I grow this amount? And it
Right.
just that like Kickstarter fluid that you have is so powerful. And I
Yeah.
think it's like helping her to continue to add more. So that converts into, yeah, a few dollars, maybe 50, maybe 100, and dividends can keep on growing from there.
Yes, it is just, it's a magical moment. I don't care how big your first dividend check is, it's a magical moment. It's like, wow, this is how the rich people get rich. This is all that stuff that Warren Buffett has been talking about, here it is. It's amazing. It is one of my favorite things. Yes, I love doing that with my kids as well. I've gotten, I have five kids, or we have five kids, and what's amazing is we have sat down with them and tried to get them to open up a brokerage account. We've even bribed them. Hey, if you open up a brokerage account, we're going to put some money in there for you. And out of five kids, I think two have opened up a brokerage account. So we're still hopeful, but it just goes to show you there is a lot of resistance there. Let me ask you this, kind of put you on the spot a little bit. What sets your book apart from other personal finance books out there in the marketplace?
Yeah, great question. I asked my friends that before I wrote the book. I was like, why aren't you taking action towards your personal finance? Like, we were all broke college kids at one point. Now we are learning to be better, but why are we not educating ourselves? What is that gap? And to the point, like, I even like one of my favorite books, personal finance books out there is I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi. Great book, highly recommend. I even took that book and handed it to one of my friends, and she read the first few pages and she's like, this is great, but I just don't care enough. So I thought to myself, man, like that really, you can teach a, you know, like you can, like give a man a fish, but you can't like always teach them how to fish, especially if they don't want it, right? Like it is up to them if they choose to make this decision for themselves. So I sat down and I'm like, why are people not doing this? What I found out is one, a lot of personal finance books are very lengthy. Two, they're helpful and they're super knowledgeable in what they're sharing, but that makes it kind of boring because it's very straight facts about how the financial system works and what that means. And people don't really care about a lot of that mumbo jumbo, especially if you're not in finance and you don't, again, study it or do it as a part of your job. And then number three, like no one has the time to do this. Like people like a light read. So the reason my book is, I think, like 66, maybe 70 pages. So that long, I've read it. I've had my dad, my brother, all of them read it. It takes anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour. You can read this in one go. And then on top of that, I've created actionable steps that you can take after every chapter. And then going back to not making it boring, I've made it super sarcastic. So it's a fun ride. You know, you're not thinking about crap, like what does this term mean? Like, should I Google it? Should I just take a picture of this book?
Right.
Like, just relax, enjoy the ride, have fun with it.
Yeah, one of the things that that I did in my fan fi again finance journey or money management journey is, like I said, I had two different newsletters, and these were memberships that were like $400 or $500 a piece, and they would give you tips on what stocks to invest in and things of that. And you still had to do your own research, and you had to eventually pull your trigger and stuff like that. I remember once I found Warren Buffett, he's become a big model for me, and so he simplified it. That's the thing I loved about him, is his basic thing is, if you're not willing to invest the hours of research that he does to decide whether he's going to buy a stock or not, he says just get an ET. It's simple. He says
Correct.
most professional money managers don't beat the S&P 500. Put your money there. And it's incredibly easy. I think that, again, just like a lot of things out there, food, health, money, there's so much overwhelm. There's so much information. And one expert tells you to do this, another expert tells you to do that. So I love the fact that you made it really simple. You threw in some fun, sarcastic wit that appeals. I think that one of the things that I remember, one of the mistakes that I made, when you're 20, thinking about retirement and thinking about adult things like a house seems like so far away. I mean, retirement is incredibly far away. I'm going to do that later. A house, maybe, but right now, an apartment's great. I don't have to mow a lawn. If something's broken, I just call somebody. Having a house, that's like extra work. That's more adult than I want to be. And not until you understand, the function of a mortgage, there are some tax benefits, things of that nature. It's just a different world. And when you're young and inexperienced, some of that stuff doesn't even make sense.
Agreed, 100%. I mean, so many 20-year-olds don't think about retirement. It is the last thing on their mind. I've even had friends who don't contribute to a 401k because they're like, ah, whatever, we'll figure it out. But the least you could do is do your 401k match. Again, most companies out there provide some sort of matching, whether it's share for share or percentage of your total contribution. And that I would say is like the least amount you can do today is just match it. That's kind of like getting free money, to be honest. It doesn't get better than that.
Absolutely, absolutely free money. I tell my kids the same thing. Just, get them to match your amount, and then put it into the EFT or whatever, but at least do the bare minimum. I agree with you there. Let me ask you this. In your opinion, what are the most common financial mistakes that you see people make, and how did you address them in your book?
Yeah, there's a lot. I'm going to try to talk about two today. Number one, what I see all the time, and again, especially younger people, is they look at one financial account or one way to, let's say, save or invest their money, and they say, okay, that's it. I did that. I'm good. I have a savings account. I'm good. I signed up for a credit card and I get points and I pay it on time, I'm good. I don't think you can stop there. If you really want to work on it, you have to have a financial system, a system that works for you. It's different for everyone, but having a checkings account, that's the backbone of everything that you're doing. A savings account for anywhere from 3 to 12 months of savings, right? Things that are upcoming in your life. And again, with savings, I always, always, always recommend a high yield savings account. There's no reason not to do a high yield savings account. On top of that, credit card is what you're using functionally for your everyday life. Then you have your brokerage account, also very easy to set up. Invest in ETFs. We just talked about it. Like ETFs, index funds are so easy to get into. And then don't stop there. Look at ESPP, look at 401k, think about real estate. If you are an expert in things like art and jewelry, I mean, these are alternate assets that you could look into. Personally, I don't know anything about any of these assets, so that's not where I'm spending my time. But I am spending time in my brokerage account as well as in real estate to continue to learn about it and then invest my money there. I just see a lot of people stop after a certain point, or they will stop after their companies have set them up with a few accounts, and that's it. And we can't rely on those anymore. And then number two, kind of going hand in hand with my first point, is automating your financial system, right? A lot of people will also say, I will save or put money in my savings account or put money in my brokerage account once I have X amount. Once I have, I don't, let's just for example purposes, once I have $5,000 in my checkings account, then I will invest my money. That mindset of first, I need to just live off or pay for tacos and pay for a movie, and then I will invest. Is so, I wish we could flip that in people's mindset and say, first, I will invest, let's say $1,000. Again, just making numbers up, it's different for everyone. Then I have $400, and then I can eat tacos and go to a movie. And so this way, you're prioritizing and automating like your investment into your brokerage account and your savings. These are so easy to set up online. And now you have that limited amount of money to work with for your day-to-day purchases. So the whole system, there's another like business book called Profit First, that if you've read it, it's really, really good. But basically the idea is you want to pay yourself first. You want to have the profit first. So what if you could do that in your personal life as well and make sure you're saving and investing first and then living off your expenses?
Yes, Profit First. Is that by Mike Michalowicz?
Correct, yeah.
Yes. It's a
Great
good
book.
book. It's been out a few years. Highly recommended as well. It is so weird. It's so funny how we don't pay ourselves first.
Yeah.
And for those individuals out there, I just want to say a collection of Nike shoes is not a different asset class. I know that there are some people out there who collect these shoes, and yes, maybe they make some money off of it, but it's not what I would consider a traditional asset class, and it's hard to liquidate as opposed to having stocks.
Right.
Man, you can liquidate it. I mean, real estate is great if you don't need to liquidate it.
Liquidated. Yep.
Yeah, but to me, having stocks, that's something that you can liquidate in case you have an emergency, or maybe you want to buy that house and now you can liquidate it and pay it that way.
Yep.
I would, if you don't mind taking a few more minutes and maybe elaborating on how in how important it is leveraging these different financial accounts, because I think you're right. Most people are just fine having a checking account, but I love this idea of having different financial accounts, and how can we maximize this?
Yeah. It's to be honest, this is very hard to answer because it really is dependent person to person. The way, and this is how I've laid out my book as well. Again, like from ramen noodles to riches, I go over what are the basics what are assets and liabilities? And then I talk about one account at a time. So we're starting with checkings account. That is the backbone of your system. That is where you're getting your W-2 income. Any other income is going into your checkings account. And then I think my second chapter is on savings. So now you have your checkings account. How do we go into saving some of that portion? And then from there on, again, I talk about credit cards, and then I talk about brokerage, and then I do go into details as far as like stocks versus ETFs versus mutual funds. What does that mean for me? So the way I've like written the book, if you're a complete beginner, start at the first chapter, set that up. You have a few action items you can take. Once you're done with that, go to chapter two, step two, right? Set up that account, transfer a little bit of money, and continue to build from there. So I think to your point, like getting to a brokerage account should be the norm at this point. Everyone should be able to and should invest in stocks, ETFs, index funds, anything of that matter. It's all online. I mean, banking is all online these days anyways. The newer generation, I think, trusts technology a little bit more. So that's good for us in the financial literacy field where we can continue to drive that message and people can take that action easily, literally on their phone. But then again, like as you want to dive deeper into it, think about like what asset classes you want to build and what you want to learn about. At the end of the day, you have to be a little bit curious and motivated to grow your assets.
Yes, absolutely. I always tell my kids and anybody else who asks me is you're looking to invest, and I want to get your opinion on this. You want to invest in companies that you know, like, and trust. If you consume Coca-Cola and you like Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola happens to be one of those companies that pays a dividend. It's I think routinely around the $50 mark, and on average, I think year to year it pays something like I think 13 or 14% return, which is pretty good. And
It's one
again,
of the
like you,
highest dividend paying companies out there and has been for a while.
yeah,
Good
and
company to invest in.
I think so too. I think that I also want to ask you this. I'm sorry, let me back up. I want to ask you about eliminating debt. Are you a big proponent of get rid of the debt first and then start investing, or do you like to invest as well while you're eliminating debt?
Depends on what kind of debt. Credit card debt, if you have credit card debt, eliminate it as fast as possible. We spoke about this earlier too, right? Like credit card companies want you to have debt. That is how they're making money. You don't want that for yourself. If it's credit card, I mean, the interest rates on some of these things are 13, 20, 26%. They're insane. So if it's credit card debt, pay it as soon as possible. There are ways, like if you are looking, and again, I'm talking to the advanced folks here. If you're looking to, let's say, invest in real estate or buy a business, then leveraging debt is not a bad idea. In that case, leveraging debt could actually be good. A lot of times, people, and like I've done this myself, will take a loan out for an investment property. But if the math and the numbers work, where the investment property is making you more money than your monthly bill, then it's a good idea to be able to invest that, right? So, at that, in times like that, I think it makes sense to have and leverage that debt even further. But you just have to be able to know that for yourself. What else? I think like, car loans are interesting. A lot of peers my age, right, like in their 20s, are so quick and easy to buy a new car. Probably the worst investment you could make because they lose what, like 50% of its value as soon as they drive off the lot. Buy a used car, right? Like if you're leasing a car or if you have a brand new car, you do want to be able to pay that as soon as possible because that's just like money not doing anything for you. So it really is case by case.
It is one of the things also that I enjoy about today because of the different technologies that are in play is you can take a used car and rent it out on Turo. Now you have an asset. Now you have something that's making you money. One of the biggest breakthroughs for me, speaking of assets, was Rich Dad Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki. And in his book, he explains an asset makes you money. Just because you have a car Even though some people do call that an asset, if it's not making you money, he says, I don't call it an asset. And that to me was like a game-changing way of looking at things. Yes, you might live in a house and you might even have a good equity in that house, but if it's not making you money, don't look at it as an asset. So I just thought that was a brilliant, for me, it was a brilliant aha moment thing.
I know.
It's
So I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. So I also talk about student loans. Student loans are also, you get education from it. Education's very important, huge believer in it, right? But it's not making you money. It allows you to at someday make money. So I think student loans, car loans, and then first like homeowner, if you're living in that home, these are all liabilities in my opinion, or at least definitely not assets, because you are not making money in either one of those situations. Again, unless you're renting it out on Turo, unless you're Airbnb your home, unless there are specific caveats to your situation, then it could be considered an asset.
Yeah, so my thing on student loans, and this will take a little bit of work, but there are different programs out there that'll help you. Most financial aid offices can help you. If not, there are companies out there online that will help you, and I would maximize your grants. There are literally thousands of grants out there that you may qualify for, maybe not thousands, but at least hundreds that you may qualify for that you don't have to pay any of that money back. The other option is to kind of to what your point was, if you can afford to rent a 3-bedroom apartment and maybe rent out the other 2 bedrooms where you're not having to pay for your apartment, that is something to consider. The
House hacking.
yeah, I mean, and one of the things that again you have to be weary about is that what if a bedroom goes empty for a month or two? That's why you have to have a little bit of a cushion. But in today's marketplace, especially if you're in a college town, I have a friend of mine. Now, what they did is they actually bought a 3-bedroom condo for it, and they were renting out not the bedrooms, but the beds.
Oh,
And so
wow.
they were getting like $400 or $500 per bed, and they
Her
had two
bed.
beds per bedroom. And that's how they did it. I thought that was phenomenal
One
because.
of my favorite properties that I've invested in right now is in a college town, and it's fantastic. Like, you know, there will always be students living in that situation. And then also just renting out part of your apartment is such a great way in larger cities. Again, I live in New York, very, very expensive to live here. There's two models. Like, one, I was just talking to one of my friends, and she is leasing her apartment, but she's able to cover, and I think it's like a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom apartment. It's like deeper, it's not in Manhattan, it's like deeper in Brooklyn. So she's able to afford the rent every month on the 3-bedroom, 2-bath apartment by herself, like on her income. And so anytime she does have people, and it's called rental arbitrage, right? Like, when you are renting, but then you're also renting it out, which that's what she does for the other two rooms. She's not making an income, but she's decreasing her cost to the apartment, which does help tremendously, right? Like, especially if she wants to travel or do anything else with her money. And so depending on kind of her flexibility and what she wants to do, she will rent one or two out of those bedrooms out at any given time. And I think that's such a great way to go about it.
Absolutely. I think that you can be creative. The other thing that a lot of people don't do is they don't negotiate. You can negotiate almost anything. You can negotiate your interest rates on a lot of things. You can refinance in some cases if that makes sense to do that. For example, if you are financing your car through a bank, go to a credit union. And usually they're 2 to 3% lower than a bank. So if you're at 8% at your bank, you could go to a credit union and maybe get a 5 or 6% deal. And unlike refinancing your house, there's no, what do they call it? origination fee. There's no
Yep.
fee.
Oh
So,
yeah, no,
you
so
know,
much. The other
that
thing
could
I'll
be.
add to that is, yeah, negotiation is such a, I mean, like that's a life skill that I think everyone needs to have. So yes, we talked about negotiating for interest rates. I've negotiated some of my banking fees as well, where I've, I don't even know, like I think I paid one of my accounts late, so I had like a $35 fee. Granted, it's only $35. I called in and I was like, hey, I've been a customer of yours for the last 3 years. Can you like erase this one time? And they've taken it off. But the big thing I want to point out here, negotiation goes both ways. So yes,
Yes.
it definitely, like we are talking about reducing your costs, but you can also negotiate how much you're getting paid. And negotiating your salary and your pay is equally as important, if not more, as negotiating your costs and interest rates for a lot of these things. Because at the end of the day, like your income limit or how much you can earn is technically infinite, right?
Right.
Like technically, there's no finite limit on how much you'll get paid. And it could be across all of these different asset classes that you're building. But if you have $500 in your bank account, you can only save $500. But with your income, if you're earning, I don't know, $500, you can renegotiate that to earn $600 or whatever that might be. And I just want people to be conscious of both aspects, and be able to talk about it.
Absolutely. The other thing that I think messes people up is fear, doubt. I don't want to do that because I'm young and inexperienced. What I'm just getting started. So when my daughter-in-law was just graduated, she's a graphic designer, which I think is a very, very competitive field. There's just so many graphic designers. She got this job, and to your point, I helped her negotiate her salary, and she got exactly the salary she wanted.
Amazing.
And then just today, I'm watching YouTube, and there's this teenager. He's 18 years old or 19. He's a teenager, no experience. He quits MIT to start a weapons company. He raises $85 million because he had the courage to ask. I mean, but he's 18 or 19. He's never produced a weapon. He's never run a company, and somehow he raised $85 million on an idea that it possibly, maybe someday might work. So if you think you're not young enough, you don't have an experience, that's in your head. If you don't ask, you never get. The other thing is, I don't know if you guys can see this, free money. This is I just got this, and it's one of those books. This guy is all over the internet. His name is Matthew Lesko, and I got this on Amazon. I think it was like 50 or 60 bucks or whatever, but it's got all the different grants for all the different things that are out there. Our government, because they have so many different programs. We hear about this all the time. We hear people complain about this all the time. During COVID, there was trillions and trillions of dollars that were given away. One of my favorite examples of stupid spending during this COVID period was Kodak, the film company, right?
Oh, interesting.
So,
I thought you were going to bring up toilet paper.
well, I mean, so what happened, for those who don't know, with Kodak, again, they're a film company. They don't produce vaccines, but they got, I believe they got $30 million to help produce a vaccine. They're a film company. It's like, what? And so I just thought, okay, I got to find out what's out there. That's actually why I got that book. The other thing, back to COVID and these trillions of dollars that were given away, and you'll hear politicians complain about it, that in this bill here, there was a like $40 or $50 million that they were donating to like the Kennedy Arts Center, some other different art institutes, that they were giving millions of dollars during COVID. Like, that doesn't make sense. Can't we just put more money into treatment or whatever? And so my point be here for everybody is that there are so many things out there. There's so many ways to get money that in a lot of cases you don't even have to pay back. But just like money, we have to educate ourselves. We've got to take the time to do that.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I hadn't heard of that book before, so.
All right, so let me ask you, here you are, you're about to write your book. Any fear, any hesitation, any self-doubt about putting out this book?
I think by the time I started writing the book, I had worked through a lot of it in my head. And again, like a lot of it, everything money related, it's a very personal thing, right? Money is such a touchy topic to people, and I totally understand that. I think for me, what was hard was really bringing this topic up in front of others, in front of my boyfriend, in front of my friends, in front of my family, and speaking about it more openly than I ever have. But that was the journey I had before I wrote the book. So at the time I started writing, I was like, okay, this is purely to make sure other people have this information on their hands, and I am sick and tired of there not being enough like resources for people. Again, we've talked about there are some, but I want to make it even easier, even simpler. I want it to be 1 + 1 = 2 kind of deal. And that was the idea with my book.
Yes, one of the things I love about your book, as you pointed out, it's an easy read. It's not 200 or 300 pages. It's not a bunch of terms that people have to look up. You can read it in an hour or whatever, and start implementing the strategies in the book. And as you and I have already talked, this is stuff that the sooner kids learn this stuff, the better off they're going to be. So maybe your book may not be perfect for the elementary kids, but it sounds like it might be a good match for junior high, high school, even the first year of college.
Yeah, I mean, it's called From Ramen Noodles to Riches for a reason, right? Like, we've all, I don't know about you, but I definitely have had multiple occasions where I'm eating ramen noodles in college, but not just college, even up to like 2 to 3 years after graduating. And so I've had those moments where I'm like, crap, like, I don't have enough money. Marachin, sure, 99 cents, we'll make it work. So it's really about that transition going from college into adult life. At the same time, though, I've had coworkers who are in their mid-30s, what is that, like 10, 15 years out of college, and still struggle with some of these concepts of, oh, I can put my money in other accounts besides my checkings. I've had coworkers that have had tens of thousands of dollars sitting in their checkings account, not doing anything with it, not even putting an index fund, right? Like that is the easiest thing, and they're just losing money on that. Especially if you've been in the industry for 15 years and your money's just been sitting there. So yes, of course, this book is geared towards people making that transition into getting your first job, setting up accounts, learning about it, getting a good, like basic overall understanding. But also I've had coworkers who are 30s and 40s and parents like dads who have read it and told me, wow, like this is really helpful. So it's
Yeah.
really where you are, no judgment. The other thing is like we can all start where we are, right? Like it really like financial education is at our fingertips and we need to be able to take account. And I do believe that everyone's capable of it.
Absolutely. As you said earlier, money is very personal. We're all at different levels, different places, and so it doesn't matter. But to your point, start work from where you're at. If you wait until you have X amount of dollars, don't. I would say open up a brokerage account today. They're usually free to open. Some of them require a minimum, but like Robinhood doesn't require a minimum. You can open it up with 5 or 10 bucks. Just start doing it today. And one of the things that people don't understand, money, or better yet, investing, is like a habit, like anything else. Just like not investing, it becomes a habit. Investing is a habit. And when you start buying companies that you know, like, and trust, And then you get those little dividends, or you buy it for $10 and then all of a sudden it's worth $12. That's, again, it's in one sense, it's not a whole lot of money, but on the other sense, it is. It's incredible. This is the same thing that people like Warren Buffett and all the other investment gurus out there are doing. They're just doing it on a bigger scale because they got started sooner.
I started by investing $50 a month. 50. That's, yeah. I mean, if I would have started sooner, maybe I would have started with 10, but I wish I did. That's the only regret I've ever had is I wish I started sooner. And that again goes back to not knowing enough at that time.
Yes, and that's, I think that's a great example. Look, $50. I know a lot of
Like
people will
two meals
say,
now.
what's that?
$50 is like two meals in this day and age.
Well, you're in New York now, so it might be a meal and a half.
Yeah. Let's not talk about how expensive it is.
But yeah, absolutely. It does, again, this is the thing that holds people back. This doubt that, well, $50 isn't that much. It's not in one sense, but $50 a year later, what is that? $600, 600.
Compounds over time too.
Yeah, not to mention it compounds, but as
Yeah.
opposed to $50 that you throw away, you have nothing.
That's what I mean by I think that's the biggest mistake people make is because $50 feels like nothing, they're like, oh, I will wait until I have $500 to invest. Well, no, can we just skip the waiting and start with 50 because that is a start. You know, and like you said, it's a habit. And if you continue to work on it, like 50 per month will become 500 at some point. And at least you've started instead of waiting for that to happen.
Absolutely. I just remembered a story that my banker told me. He had this kid who would come to the bank and deposit into a savings account every week. And on some weeks, his deposit was less than $2. But he
Wow.
did it anyway because he wanted, he was building that habit. And the minute, and again, this is one of those things that we don't understand. Even Einstein could not comprehend how compound interest worked. He said it was one of those things that logically you understand it to some extent, but it does all of a sudden start to pick up steam. And so you can look up that quote about Albert Einstein and interest, and it's amazing, or compound interest. So here's a guy who's coming into the bank. This is back in the day when you had to physically come into the bank, and he's making a $2 deposit, sometimes less, sometimes more. But guess what? The chances of him retiring early, the chances of him misusing his money are much lower than the person who's waiting to have $500 before they get started.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I love that story. That's really, really powerful. I guess that's why physical banks could be helpful in this day and age. I do everything electronically.
Absolutely, absolutely. The good thing is that you can do it electronically. The bad thing is that it's right there at your fingertips, and you can take it out. I
Yeah,
think.
actually, one of the other things I share in my book, I don't know if I'll be able to open it in time right now, but I have a diagram of like how money should flow. And that I think would be really helpful for people getting started because it literally shows, you know, that flow can be replicated by setting up those like online invest or sorry, online recurring payments to your bank account. And I think that's very helpful. And that's again how I have it set up. It's just I could die today and my money would still be investing and still be saving. So that's a really a great way to set up your financial system. So
And
it's really
speaking of, oh, there it is.
hard, yeah, to see.
Yep, I like that.
Yep.
But something else that you said, and this is little, this might be advanced, I'm not sure. But you mentioned dying. I had a client, and this is just terrible. So I had a client who got divorced, got remarried. He died. He did not update the beneficiary in his brokerage account.
Oh,
So the beneficiary was his ex-wife.
wow.
So she ended up getting all of his money in that account. His new
Wow.
wife, I don't know what she ended up doing, but I think there's a lawsuit filed. Either way, it became ugly. So for those individuals, if you have a spouse or you want to leave your money to somebody, make sure you fill out that beneficiary thing. It hopefully won't be used anytime soon, but you never know. But it's one of those little details that's important. It's just something else. So, but anyway, I just love this idea of ramen noodles to rich. What is ramen?
Yeah, from ramen noodles to riches.
Ramen noodles to riches. And at least one of the takeaways from today's conversation is don't wait. Don't wait. There is no reason whether you can afford $5 a month or $50 a month or $500 a month. Don't wait. Get started today. Today is the perfect day to get started. That is at least one of my favorite takeaways from today's conversation.
And start with $10 if that's all it takes. $10 is nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
There is other different little things. For instance, I don't buy coffee. I don't buy soda pop. I don't buy juices. Out there, right? Yes, occasionally I'll buy water because I think that's more important. But I cannot justify going to a place like Starbucks and spending $5 or $6 or $7 on a drink,
Yeah.
or going to a juice bar and again spending $5 or $6 or $7 on a drink. It doesn't make sense to me. The other thing, I want to get your take on this, by the way.
Yeah. I
Because
know ours.
right now we've become this crazy tipping whirlpool. I mean, everybody's asking you for a tip. You know,
Yeah.
you go to pick up your dry cleaning and they flip that little thing around and it's like, leave me a tip. For what?
Yeah.
I don't consider myself a cheapskate, even though I do consider myself frugal. I don't tip everybody just because you
Yeah.
ask.
No, I'm with you on tipping culture. It's becoming insane. And I remember back in the day where the options were like 10, 15, 20, and now the options are 22, 25, 28, which that's just ridiculous at this point. And also, I think that tipping culture is increasing to the point where it's not just for services. I understand if like a there's a service, people are bringing food out to you, they're cleaning up after you, totally makes sense. But sometimes you're tipping, yeah, at a coffee shop without even getting your drink. What if your drink is absolutely horrible and it's the worst service you've ever seen, right? So what are you tipping for? I don't understand that either. I'm with you. On the buying lattes or fancy coffee or fancy juice, I might have a different take. I think it's okay.
Ahead. Okay.
I think if it makes you happy, it's okay. Obviously, if this is your everyday routine, maybe try making it at home. Maybe try changing some of your habits. But in my opinion, a lot of the times, like what I see people doing too, is they'll be like, crap, I'm not going to pay $5 for this coffee. I'm not going to pay $5 for this juice. Oh, but let me go spend $500 on a flight ticket to London just because I'm feel like going to London, right? Like, I think the bigger expenses are what you could maybe think about deeper than the $5 latte. And if this like $5 latte is helping you become, again, like happier towards your life, I think that ultimately is what's important, as long as it's not a recurring thing, and as long as it's not like you're not spending on a meal outside, breakfast, dinner, lunch, coffee, dessert, everything, it all adds up.
Right.
So it's like one of my first sentences on here, I'm like, honestly, sip that $8 latte guilt-free while I spill the beans on how to get your financial shit together. So
To your point, you do have to do these things that make you happy. You cannot be such a miser
yeah.
that you hate your life.
That's right. What's the
This is
point
a
then?
Yeah, so it is a balance. For example, I don't spend my money on those fancy drinks. I do spend my money on a massage.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, see, I think everyone has their own thing, right? Like,
Yes.
I like spending, like, I only have, I don't know, maybe 20, 15 to 20 things in my closet, but they're really nice 15 to 20 things. Whereas my sister, her closet is filled and it's just whatever. Like, I like investing in the pieces of clothing I'm wearing, but I don't spend on, I don't know, I don't spend on like ridiculous hotels. I don't care about where I'm staying, but I will spend on experiences or
Yes.
activities. So I think it just depends on who you are. But as long as you recognize that you don't have to follow your friends or your family and spend on whatever they're spending on, then that's okay. Like I've had friends who are really into, yeah, Nike sneaker collection. They're all what, like $100 to $300. That's fine, but I realize that I don't need to spend $100 to $300 on 12 pair of Nike shoes, but they can. That's their thing, you know.
Right.
So what's your thing, and what is it that you want to spend on?
Right. And again, I look at if I'm really going to collect Nike shoes or whatever, I would definitely do the research. I know there's people out there who collect these shoes because it gives them significance. It makes them feel cool. I can wear a different pair of shoes every day. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that if you're doing the other stuff, right? So if you got your automatic investments going and this is your I don't know, your version of a latte or a
Your fun
massage,
money. I call
your
it a
fun
fun
money.
money. I
Yes.
actually have a high yield savings account called Vacation Slash Fun, and I put
Yes.
in like $100 every month. And when it gets to, you know, a certain amount, I'm like, okay, well, I have saved to have fun. Therefore,
Yes.
I can, you know, travel or buy whatever I want.
Yes. So I'm glad you brought that up because what I use is Acorns. Are you familiar with
Okay,
Acorns?
I'm familiar with them. Yeah, I don't use them personally, but I've heard they're.
Okay. Yeah. So for you guys who are not familiar, Acorns you can put it on credit cards and debit cards. So every time you spend money, you can set the amount of money, it'll round it up. So you can set it so it'll round up to the next quarter. So if you bought something for, let's say, $1.10, it will take 15 cents out of your account and put it in your Acorns account. Or you can say, I want to round up to the next dollar. So again, you bought a $1.10 item, it's going to take 90 cents out of your account and put it in your Acorns account. So that is my fun money slash Christmas fun. At the end of the year, I'll have a couple thousand dollars there that came out of nowhere, right? It's the equivalent. So when I was growing up, we'd have this thing called a change jar, and you just put all your extra change. But currency, physical currency is becoming less and less usable or use. So Acorns, I think, is a great thing for people who don't want to feel the pinch, and maybe they have difficulty saving here and there or whatever. So I'll just put that out there. Yeah, you cannot be, again, you can't be such a miser that you just hate your life because you're not having any fun at all. There is a IRS agent. I remember this, to me, it was such a great illustration. This is an IRS agent. She had worked for the IRS, I think, all of her career, and she made whatever she made, 60, 70, 80 grand a year. She passed away. She had like a net worth of like $3 million. And she had no family. She had no children. The only places she would travel to is to shareholders meetings. And so I felt bad for her to die with $3 million. And all that money went to the university. I forgot what it was, which is great. University got a bunch of money. But again, you have to have that balance because it would have been nice for her to say, hey, look at all the stuff, to have a memory. Like you said, a bunch of experiences where she's traveled the world. I'd much rather die. It would be great to be able to plan it out so where you die with with not necessarily all your money, but at least with all of your memories and experiences. I think that's ultimately what we want to do. The reason you and I are talking about money today, not because we necessarily want to save all of it, but we want to have enough money for our future so we don't have to work until we're 70 or 80.
Yeah, you want to have enough money for the lifestyle you want. One of the exercises I did when I got into personal finance was, why do I want to earn money? What am I building my income and my asset classes for, right? Like, what is the reason for it? And then I really like literally like I wrote it down. I sat down with myself and I'm like, this is the kind of life I want to live. How can I make it happen for me? And that's where it, like this entire thing began for me, right? It's very, very important to be real with yourself. No one's looking at your piece of paper and saying, you don't want Nike shoes, you're not cool enough. You know, like it is your dream, it is your life. So do what makes sense for you. And then the other thing too for me is ha like leaving that legacy behind is really, really important. So for your kids, for your grandkids, making it easier on them, whether it is if it is money or if it is just the educations, like you were saying, your with your kids, you teach them how to think in an entrepreneur's perspective. And I think that's incredible. That itself is worth $1 million right there. You know what I mean? Because if you can teach them to think and act like that, they will be able to pick it up on their own, even if they don't have a dollar to their name.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yes, I do want to stress, and I agree with what you're saying. You have to make it personal. How is this going to work for you? What is the lifestyle that you want at the end of the day? If you want to be able to afford your latte every day, nothing wrong with that. Figure out how to do it. One of my favorite things, again, that I learned from Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad, is if he wants a fancy car, the first thing he does, he'll buy an asset to fund the fancy car.
That's right.
Right? Remember
I
that? And
love that
so,
concept.
yeah. And so that's a great way of thinking. Again, with your friend who rents out the rooms so she doesn't pay the full cost of that rent, that extra money gives her a much better lifestyle. She's got more flexibility. Anyway, so yes, it's very personal. You get to customize it to what fits you. And I love this thing that you said. What is the lifestyle I want and how do I make it happen? That's two great questions. And that's it.
Write it down. Just write down the answers for yourself. 100%. It makes such a you're I know most people will think about it and know it for themselves, but it's not real until you write it down.
Yes. Write it down. One of my favorite places to write things down is in the mirror, right? The bathroom
Oh,
mirror.
very cool.
Because you can see it every day and you don't forget about it. And I want to say this. Some people scoff at writing our goals down, or they scoff at writing down these things that we're talking about. As humans, we forget anniversaries, we forget birthdays, we forget court dates, right? We actually, I know people who have forgotten plane tickets. So if you don't think writing it down is important, then you don't know what you're talking about. All right. I've had so much fun getting to know you and talking money with you. I'd love to bring you back and talk more.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, Bert. This was such a great conversation.